we're delighted to welcome this week's speaker, Dhruv Raina, from JNU in Delhi. Dhruv has been over as part of the sort of exploring traditions, well, I don't know what to call it, colossus that has come about at Cambridge, and will culminate in another workshop at the end of this month, which is on Friday the 30th of May. I believe it's actually in this room, I think I'm right in saying. So hope to see you all there. And there are many amazing speakers, including two papers from Dhruv on that day, but also papers from various others and a couple of roundtables thrown into the mix as well. But anyway, for now, we're delighted to have Dhruv here. He's going to give a paper entitled The Modernity of Calculus in India and Beyond, 19th Century Beginnings, Late 20th Century Debates. And it will be opened up to questions afterwards, so if everyone could have questions waiting, that would be great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank three institutions and Simon and Sujit for having invited me to speak to you all today on the modernity of calculus in India and beyond. Several years ago, I was fortunate enough to listen to a series of lectures by Hans Belting, the German historian of art. And at that lecture, he sort of, during those lectures which I attended, he basically set out the theme of this book, which is now available in English, Florence Renaissance, Florence and Baghdad, Renaissance Art and Arab Science, where he basically makes the point how certain ideas of optics of the Arab scientist savant Ibn al-Haytham on perspective, his ideas of optics traveled to Florence and basically influenced the emergence of perspective in Western in European painting. And at that lecture, Belting constantly differentiated between what he would call the history of global art and the global history of art. And the history of global art, he saw, was a history of a movement which was no more than probably 100 years or 120 years old. But the global history of art was something else. But when I look at this, the title of this book, I am often given to think where exactly would Belting place his own work. Would he circumscribe it to a period extending over 100 years, or was global art a much older movement? Therefore, I'd like to turn this question around to the audience rather than the audience asking me what do we then mean by global science? And what I say, I'm going to stretch this. I'm not going to say global science is something that comes into being with the beginning of or in the wake of colonialism as the institutions of modern science spread and are transmuted in different cultural contexts. But I'm going to stretch this boundary a little, saying that there's a lot of movement that predates the beginnings of what we might call global science. Now, so basically, the talk is in two parts, but there is a related theme. The first part of the talk is more about the introduction of calculus in 19th century India, and over here I would argue that, rather than look at the old, speak in terms of the old diffusionist metaphor, Schapen once put it as truth flowing from regions of high truth concentration to regions of low truth concentration. We look at the connected histories of calculus, of processes simultaneously taking place between India, the introduction of calculus in India and the introduction of calculus in England are, entangles the buzzword, deeply connected. And I discuss some of those debates. The second part is about a priority dispute. And this priority dispute is more recent, dates back to the late 1990s. And this has to do with the origins of calculus. And this priority dispute is not whether Newton did it first or Leibniz did it first, but that a bunch of Keralite mathematicians in the 15th century did it before anybody else could. And this is not for the whole of calculus, but basically some procedures, protocols, and algorithms in calculus, which it is claimed traveled to Europe in the 16th, the early 17th century. Since the only people who were around on the coast of Malabar at the time were the Jesuits, it is argued that the Jesuits were the most likely source of transmission. And since the evidence is not showing up, the members of this group are now speaking of other routes of transmission, some which they rule out. The Arab route is ruled out. They're talking about oral or non-textual sources of the transmission of this knowledge. What brings these two works together is the idea of the modernity of calculus. And I shall not go into this discussion in too much of a detail. I have about half an hour. But basically, I mean, a lot of my reflection on this has been inspired in the recent years by Michael Dodson's book on the 19th century, where he basically departs from a certain understanding of the introduction of modern systems of education in the 19th century, and he talks about more, we were told that there was this Orientalist-Anglicist controversy which ends in 1835 with the passing of the Macaulayan Minute, and lo and behold, a new system of education is introduced. And basically what he's arguing in a more complex way is that this process of so-called engraftment continues throughout the century almost to the end of the 19th. Towards the end of the 19th century. Now, in that argument, of course, he says, through the work of the British Indologists, we begin to hear a chorus that, Sanskrit is the most perfect of all languages, it is the most beautiful of all languages, and basically, however, it suffers from a deficit. And the deficit is that it cannot accommodate the new sciences. All right, and then this becomes the mechanism for what, to use a phrase from the Indian sociologist, Yogendra Singh, the modernization of a tradition. Now, what I would argue is that a similar argument could be extended to the domain of mathematics within the frame of the engraft. Within the frame of engraftment, it would be argued, and it is said so that it was a conciliatory policy. You start by saying that the Indian mathematics and Western mathematics rest on the same principles. All right? However, and this is a second-order interpretation, it is an interpretation derived from the works of Colebrooke, that in the Indian tradition, mathematics is very highly developed. Actually, Colebrooke can be held responsible for both, for the argument in language as well as the argument in mathematics, that in the Indian tradition, arithmetic is better developed than algebra. They have greater skill in algebra. That algebra is better developed than geometry. They have greater skill in geometry. This is a very old tradition. And therefore, if you wish to introduce new ideas about calculus, one is we have to get around the problems of geometry, and only then can we introduce it to the new geometry. So in either case, what happens is that there is a deficit theory and you work within the deficit theory for the modernization of a tradition. However, we must know that if you go back to the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century histories of science, this is a paper I wrote many years ago on Lejeune and Jean-Sylvain Bailly, you often encounter in the histories of science what I would like to call a disruption in the narrative of progress. And the disruption in the narrative of progress is, at some point, Jean-Sylvain Bailly or Delambre would say, but you encounter algorithms in this tradition here that predate Kepler by 300 years. And there's a problem because the Enlightenment historians are writing a history of progress. Science is a sphere where the history of science is the history of the progress of human intelligence. All right? Now, in that history of progress, How are you going to accommodate this disruption in the narrative of progress? Now, various strategies are developed, which I shan't go into say, but I would just like to mark this on the side. Yeah? Okay. Now, this is the work by Colebrooke, which basically puts forward this idea, and there are passages from this work which I quote from the paper. I can give you the passage, which, you know, it's almost a passage which you see in any work you encounter at the time. You see it in Cajori, you see it in Augustus de Morgan. It's like a chorus that you encounter again and again. Just a minute. In short, they cultivated algebra much more and with greater success than geometry, as is evident in the comparatively low state of their knowledge in the one and the high pitch of their attainments in the other. All right? This is the key passage. And I mean, it's a passage which has a very long life, a very deep life. You will see it in most histories of mathematics at the time. Now, an important figure here is De Morgan, is Augustus De Morgan. He's a mathematician, an algebraist, who claims he was born in India, and he becomes a very important interlocutor between mathematics teachers in India and mathematics teachers in Europe. He himself is deeply involved in England in a commission for the reform of mathematics education and the place of mathematics education in a liberal reform, of mathematics education in a liberal educational program. Okay, so he is involved in that. Now, what I would argue is that De Morgan's works are translated into India in several of the vernaculars. Now, this is a Maharashtrian a translation in Marathi of De Morgan's book, The Elements of Algebra, Bija Ganitya Mula Patika, in which the word Bija or Bija Ganita is translated as the equivalent of algebra. All right. So this is the foundational work then on algebra, which is translated into Marathi. This is Anka Ganitacha Mulapatika. And this is a work on the elements of arithmetic. Okay. Now, in around about 1840, I here recuperate some of the work my colleague and collaborator and friend Irfan Habib and I did in the 1990s. We worked on the person you see above, a maths teacher called Master Ramachandra. He's not just a mathematician. He's one of the founders of modern Urdu journalism, amongst the founders of modern Urdu journalism, and one of the first science journalists in Urdu in about 1830s or so. He writes a book on calculus in the Urdu called the Sariul Fahim. The head of public instruction in Delhi sees the work, a Dr. Sprenger, and he says, you know what, this book addresses some of the problems we have with calculus education in England as well. Would you do a translation? So he does a translation. It's published in Delhi in 1851. The book is sent to De Morgan, and De Morgan presses for its translation in England. This is the translation that appears in, I don't know if you can see it, in London in 1859. It's a book called A Treatise on Maxima and Minima, where, in a way, you are postponing the introduction of calculus. You are postponing the introduction of calculus simply because it is felt that we have not resolved all the problems concerning the teaching of calculus. All right? So the debate is still on. There's still a negotiation going on. Is the problem of differentiation okay? Why do we think that calculus came to us well-defined in the works of Newton and Leibniz? So there's a whole teaching context there within which there are debates going on calculus. And here you are postponing this moment. And so De Morgan thinks, yeah, you can teach children in England, you can teach school children in English in England and college teachers in England to obtain the maxima or the minima of an algebraic expression without differentiation, without going to calculus. All right. So De Morgan writes a 40-page introduction to the book, which sets the ground for De Morgan's work and calls the problem that De Morgan addresses in the work the Ramachandra problem. All right. So it's given a name that this is a problem which he resolves, and this should be used in mathematics teaching. In 1857, there's the mutiny, and you know, Ramachandra had to run away from Delhi because at some moment he had converted to Christianity, and so he was seen as an ally of the East India Companies. Then he comes back in 1861, and he writes a second book, and the second book is a specimen of a new method of the differential calculus called the method of constant ratios. So the point is now that he is going on from this problem of maxima and minima in calculus to another level. And he's saying, no, there are issues about differential calculus which have not been resolved. All right? And over here, when he gets into that, oh no, this is a picture of, well, to show you the process of engraftment, we have in the middle Bapudeva Shastri, one of the people who translates Bacon, who translates Bacon along with Ballantyne into Sanskrit. Over there, he's sitting with an astrolabe and surrounded by senior students as well as beginners on the right-hand side. Yeah. Now, yeah, have I got that as yet? Yeah, okay. Now, that Ramachandra's problem had not gone away despite his writing of the book. The publication of his work is reflected further in an article which a computer scientist working with computational procedures called Muses wrote in the Mathematical Intelligencer, labeled De Morgan's Ramanujan, like Hardy's Ramanujan, De Morgan's Ramanujan is Ramachandra. And over there, there's an oblique reference to a book which is published in either the United States or Canada by Ivan Niven, talking about maxima and minima without calculus. So in ways, the problem has stayed on. It has stayed on over 150 years. You know, I mean, no closure has been achieved around the methods of calculus. You know, you still want to say, do you have to introduce this person to the notion of the infinitesimal? Do you still have to introduce the person to the notion of the limit? So you're still trying to do algebra without doing calculus. Now, what was the specimen responding to? The specimen, I mean, Ramachandra's specimen of a new method. And it was responding to all the objections concerning calculus. And what I've given here is a short list of books which figure in the specimen as highlighting what would be the problems of calculus, how do we get around them, can we come up with a new method for teaching calculus to college children or to introduce it in school, I mean college students and school children. This is at about close to the halfway point, right? There are two things I would like to draw from it. That if you look into the priority disputes of calculus, which my colleagues have raised, there seems to be an assumption about calculus, that calculus comes out full form, you know, in the works of Newton and Leibniz. It acquires a cogent identity by the middle of the 18th century, and it is introduced into schools and colleges in the 19th century, and that, it is this theory about calculus we are opposing, this theory of the introduction of calculus, this idea of the introduction of calculus that we are opposing. And why I give you this 19th century story is to basically sort of say that there were many genealogies. And we cannot say that, you know, there is one genealogy that derives either from Newton or from Leibniz, that it is opening out, and it opens out in several ways. And therefore, what are we speaking about? Which calculus are you really speaking about? The second is that there is a tendency, and where historians of science and historians of mathematics, when looking at 19th century context, tend to focus increasingly upon the works of arrived scientists, you know, the important figures, Babbage and De Morgan and Boole. But a lot of this work, this, you know, what engineers will call troubleshooting, is resolved in teaching context, which is absolutely essential to the history of science. Okay? And this is never part of this program. And I mean, I have a PhD student now who's working on physics education research, and the other day he comes to me and he says, you know what, Physics Review Letters now admits physics education research as one of the sub-disciplines like theoretical condensed matter physics and particle physics, etc. It is included in physics research as something which is to be published. So it's a recognition at the level of the scientific community, but historians of science you know, tend a little more to focus on ideas rather than teaching context from where ideas then disseminate out. Yeah. I think it's a point which, of course, I mean, I must thank James Ploskett for that, for introducing me to the work of John Eger, where he raises this whole thing about working words, although I don't know what new work it does, but yeah. All right. So we go back to our priority disputes, with this sort of reservation that which calculus are you really speaking about? Now, over here, this the Kerala School of Mathematics is basically the school whose origins are probably at the beginning of the 14th century and last well into the middle of the 17th century. In terms of its mathematics alone, it's a very, very substantial tradition. Substantial tradition in the sense that already by the time of Parameshwara and Nilakanta and Jayasudeva, they had already arrived at infinite series representations of sine functions, of the arc tan, of pi, etc. I mean, and I don't know, I mean, where this mathematical tradition really comes out for. What were the questions they were responding to? So the social history of this mathematics has still to be developed. All right. Now, one of the important texts here is the Ganita Yukti Bhasha, which has been recently translated. And, you know, I was really shocked the other day when I met a physicist who said, you know, let's forget about Newton and Leibniz. This is where it really starts. And I said, you know, I mean, no, we have to look upon this thing a little more carefully. There is something very, very important there, exceedingly important, which may be on par with something like the invention of calculus. But let us not say at the moment it is the same thing. If you go to the Journal of Indian Philosophy, which is published from Leiden, you'll see an article by a particle physicist, Divakaran, who knows both Malayalam. I mean, one of the things about this work was it was not written in Sanskrit. It was written in a vernacular in Malayalam in the 14th century. So what happens is mathematicians are now producing mathematical knowledge not in the languages of the vernacular cosmopolis, meaning Latin or Persian or Sanskrit, but now are beginning to write in vernaculars. And this is already in the 14th century, which is what my interlocutors find very, very interesting. That what is it that, you know, suddenly says, all right, we're not going to write in Sanskrit anymore, we're going to write in Malayalam. All right? So it's an important, I mean, these are surely very important things to see within a global context. I deliberately use the term vernacular cosmopolis, deriving it from the work of Sheldon Pollack, who calls the last millennium the vernacular millennium. Okay, that's the millennium we've just kind of lived through. So, yeah. Now, in this whole discussion, George Gevorgis, and Dennis Almeida, etc., drew upon, in some sense, the criteria to pin down a transmission which was set out by the historian of mathematics, Neugebauer. And Neugebauer had set down three criteria in order to establish a transmission. Chronological priority, epistemological affinity, and the third is the corridor of transmission. All right? Which is the route through which this text or this knowledge could have traveled. So they've already established at one level the chronological priority of this mathematics. They've established in some sense some epistemological affiliation, some, it's not very clear. So which is the route? And for them, the only carriers of this knowledge could have been the Jesuits who were on the coast of Malabar between 1570 and 1640. Yeah?
What the hell is epistemological affinity?
Yeah, okay, in the sense that there are ideas there or in the mathematics here, in the Kerala School of Mathematics, which lead up to calculus, that there's no disjuncture between them. Or, well, more than affinity, you would say commensurability.
It's a continuous differential curve.
All right. And in this case, they rule out the Arab route, that this knowledge could not have traveled through the Arab world. And I really think, why not? You know, I mean, why do you rule it out? Okay. Now, one of the people who worked with them on the project, is Ugo Baldini, who works on the Italian Jesuits and who really knows the Vatican archive well. He knows the archive at the Collegio Romano. And he has pointed out that it doesn't appear that there was any transmission, anything reaching Mersenne or any of these people through the Jesuits. There does not seem to be any evidence. And in any case, you're not looking after 1640, all right? You lose the question of if anything comes after 1640, already some kind of calculus and the work of the other mathematicians has been done. Now, what I would say is that I would like to give an anachronistic argument as to why the Jesuits could not have been the source of that transmission. Because finally, even Baldini says, well, I've looked at the evidence and I don't see that there was any real transmission. You haven't pinpointed anything else. But however, there is a likelihood that, okay, we could discover evidence one day. I have donkey's years now been working on the Jesuits. I really get bored of saying it sometimes myself. And I worked on the French Jesuits in India between 1650 and 1750. And an acquaintanceship with their literary practices, with their collection practices, tells me that it is unlikely that the Jesuits at all could have been a source of this transmission. Now, this is an anachronistic argument in the sense that this is the way the Jesuits wrote, this is the way Jesuits collected material from 1650s onwards, and this is the way they may have done so between 1570 and 1640. So that's the limitation of the argument. Where does the argument come from? So if you go to the work of Mordecai Feingold, Steve Harris, Rivka Feldhe, and an entire generation of scholars who worked on Jesuit science since the 1980s, they would tell you as to what we call Jesuit science. And somewhere, of course, Steve Harris also uses the phrase Jesuit colonial science, or the science of the Jesuits, which was conducted in what were the colonies, recognizing that the term Jesuit colonial science could be an oxymoron. All right. What we call Jesuit science is something which really comes into being after 1630s or 1640s. All right. So it really acquires a kind of coherent cogency after this time. Now, whatever we call Jesuit science is brought together by a set of writing practices. And this set of writing practices had been prescribed by the founder of the Jesuit order, Ignatius Loyola. All texts had to be written in a certain style, in a certain format. You had to talk about the political life of the region where you were. You had to talk about the local customs, practices, and you had to talk about their knowledge of the world around them. Keith Telscher calls this world, has labeled this as Jesuit cosmography. All right, so there was geography there, there was astronomy there, there was a bit of customs and laws, and a bit of political history. In the accounts that begin to trickle into Europe from the 1650s onwards, for the first time you begin to see that Europe begins to learn through another source of the antiquity of the sciences and knowledges of India. So it is the Jesuits, in a way, who sensitize, for example, French audiences to, well, there is this great knowledge they have of astronomy or of this or that, or okay. And this then goes into the accounts of people like Bernier. This goes into the understanding of people like Gassendi. And therefore, I do not see why the Jesuits would have disguised something which is valorized two centuries later, would have disguised it or suppressed it from readerships in Europe, that they had created or they have this advanced knowledge of mathematics. In fact, it could be said that the Jesuit Andeanists were probably the first Indologists, and you cannot go to the work of the founders of the Asiatic Society like William Jones and others. You cannot understand the reflections on the antiquity of astronomy in India without recognizing that there is a prehistory which they are relying on, and this is the Jesuit ethnography.
Now,
just a question of clarification. Are you saying that Jesuit science started in the 1630s and 40s insofar as they're importing something from abroad? Or are you ruling out...
Well,
there were people like Scheiner, I don't know they were to argue, but there were scientific astronomers and better ones than him in some respects. But they're Italian. I mean, what are you saying about Jesuit science?
Okay. No, one is I'm saying that the institutional structure of Jesuit science, the institutional structure and networks are in place from 1630s, 1640s. One. Number two, that really qualified Jesuit astronomers, astronomy, if you go by the work of Florencia, astronomy does... becomes a kind of Jesuit prerogative only after 1640. It's not that there are no astronomers before, but I mean... it's taught in Jesuit schools and seminaries, and the people who travel outside know astronomy. This is a post-1650s phenomenon.
Okay, but you would accept that in the 1620s, Galileo was in the dialogue.
Yeah,
the world systems, he's battling the Jesuit science.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Jesuits don't reject his argument, right? I mean, they say that he's not speaking. I mean, he's not wrong. That's what finally what the Jesuit, if I remember right, that's what finally the Jesuit...
Oh, no, it's a crucial error.
Yeah.
Galileo said it would take only a few hours for a cannonball to drop from the moon. And took up the Shiner, who said it would take 5 days, and it turned out Shiner was right. And it was Shiner who told the Pope to call him up. So, it's a crucial error there, I'll tell you.
Yeah, okay. Now, the Jesuit accounts were what you might call proto-ethnographic ones. Although Ines Zhupanov has criticized me for saying proto-ethnographic, because she says you assume there's a teleology, there's an evolution from the Jesuit ethnography to ethnography as it develops in the social sciences, which is, I agree with that criticism. Now, I still use the term proto-ethnography to kind of differentiate the 17th century ethnography from the later ethnography. Now, for a long, long time, I have been working on this text. It's a text which is found in the library of the Observatoire de Paris. It's a text written by a French Jesuit astronomer, Père Duchamp. It's an entirely ethnographic account of the practices, of the astronomical practices in India. And while reading this account, I mean, from two separate sources, one figured out that the Jesuits always told you, and this is from where their accounts derived a certain authority, they always told you that their account were first-person account. They had met the authorities in the field. All right? And while reading this text, suddenly you say, all right, you know, you're asking yourself, who did you talk to? Which text did you read? And suddenly the word appears... the Panchangamist, a neologism invented by the Jesuits, that they spoke to the Panchangamist. Now, the Panchangam is the almanac. So, the Panchangamist is the almanac maker. So, who the Jesuits really spoke to were the almanac makers. Now, those who know the textual corpus of Indian astronomy know that there are different kinds of texts. There are texts which are produced for the dim-witted, which are the scholarly texts, all right, the Siddhantas, and there are texts which are produced for the sharp-witted, which are the manuals, all right. It's an irony which the mathematicians adopted. And what the Jesuits read or saw were the texts produced for the sharp-witted. All right. So they would not have encountered a text like this when it came to astronomy. The second source is that this was the case was I looked at the catalogue of the Bibliothèque du Manuscrit Oriental in Paris. Now, towards the end of the 17th century, Étienne Fourmont, who was then the head of the king's library, the Bibliothèque du Roi, writes to the Jesuits, please send us a set of Sanskrit works on law, on astronomy, on culture, on philosophy, on religion. So At some point in the second decade of the 18th century, about 250 books land up, Sanskrit texts land up in the French library. If you look at the listing of those texts, there are only 8 texts on anything to do with astronomy or mathematics. It's just these. Now, the thing about these texts is, none of this is a major Siddhantic text in the Indian mathematical tradition. Not one of these. They are what one might call, within quotes, minor texts. All right? However, even if you go into, say, French Indology, or you look at the work of historians of astronomy after that, none of these works have any life afterwards. They don't appear in the footnotes of French Indologists or historians of astronomy, which means that probably they were really, really, really minor texts. So this is, in a way, I mean, I initially called it a Jesuit mystery, but now when you look at, say, the work, you know, also the internal critique of the Jesuit order, which has come from Jesuits themselves, they say that in certain areas the Jesuits did not meet the authorities in the field. All right? So this then would be the third reason why I think that the Jesuits could not have encountered this knowledge. They just talk to the Panchangamis and no one else. The last reason has to do with a slightly more complicated one, to rule out oral transmission and non-textual transmission of these texts. And that has to do with the fact that this mathematical knowledge is very, very complicated. I mean, those who know, when you compute series, I mean, how many terms can you remember orally? And therefore, what happens is, its transmission requires the development of a notation. And the development of a mathematical notation is something we begin to see in India from the 8th century onwards. All right, now over here, some of my thinking has been influenced by the work of Reviel Netz, who's been talking about the development of notation. And so the crux of my, you know, now if you look at a typical sign table, this would be a sign table in the work of Madhava. Basically, it's a verse which tells you, well, from 0 degrees to 10 degrees, keep on adding 0.002. From 10 to there, because, you know, you're defining what is like a curve, you have all these shlokas which tell you just how to generate the next term. All right? So starting from the first term, how do you generate the next terms of the series? As you move from here to a table of regiomontanus. Okay? So what happens is, at some point, a mathematical notation develops, and the evolution of this mathematical notation then requires textual transmission. Okay, so this brings me then to the end. Now, I myself am predisposed to independent discovery on this issue. I mean, that's a personal, you know, I mean, what we call Riemannian geometry in the history of mathematics, we've seen it happen very often. I mean, we know that several of the ideas of Riemannian geometry already prefigured in the work of Bollier and Lobachevsky and others. So, I mean, but that's a personal preference. Suppose we were to maintain the thesis that there was a transmission, where else could we look? Now, if you look at some of the work of Roshdi Rashid and George Saliba, they argue that it's not likely that anything substantial was transmitted in Indian mathematics and astronomy to the Arab world after the 8th or 9th century AD. So you say, okay. And then you say, but you know, I mean, from the 10th century AD onwards, there are these whole networks from the Ottomans and the Safavids and the Mughals. And so there's this movement of people, there's this movement of knowledge. And then the Indian Ocean is a bridge, in a way. All right. So is that really true? Now, what I do in the paper I've circulated is I turn an argument of George Saliba around. George Saliba has this wonderful argument paper called Arabic Science in 16th Century Europe, where he draws on this French intellectual Guillaume Postel, who was certainly familiar with Arab networks of scholars, Hebraic networks of scholars, as well was a very close friend of the Jesuits. In fact, he does play a diplomatic role in forging ties between Francis I and Suleiman the Magnificent. Now, Saliba's work talks about Postel's intense activity in collecting Arab manuscripts, even in the 16th century. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that there are certain networks in place. All right, and we should not rule out Istanbul as a new site for the collection of manuscripts. And one of the reasons is that, the texts that Goethe and Schopenhauer read at the 18th century were texts which were translations from the Sanskrit into Persian, into German, and these texts were purchased in Istanbul. So Istanbul is a site. But why is Istanbul a site? And over here, if one turns to the work of Sanjay Subramanian and Dilip Menon and others, they say that the Kerala coast must not just be seen in relationship to the Indian hinterland, but along an axis which extends from Malabar into the Arab world, into the heart of Europe. That's an axis of influence one must look at. Now, if you look at that argument carefully enough, then I really don't see why we should not look at this as a plausible route of transmission, other than just, you know, these Jesuit networks. So maybe then, I mean, if one looks at it this way, then maybe there are other modernities and just not the received notion of modernity within which the history of calculus is embedded. Let's stop here.